for the doll, and they used the Lady of the Sen. So her face is the most kissed face in history. When you're kissing a CPR doll, it's the face of a woman that was found 100 years ago in the Seine in Paris.
Thank you, Colm, as always. The winner of our hitchhiking competition is Claire Kelly. In the 80s, myself and my girlfriend were hitching from Galway to Dublin and took a lift. The driver put his arms across the seat behind my friend and started to chatter up. I felt a funny sensation in the back seat. I asked the driver to stop, but he thought I was interrupting his chat up and kept telling me to shut up. Eventually, under protest, he pulled over. My friend jumped out, but he had his arm across the seat, so it took a lot of pushing to get out of the back, and a lot of cursing and shouting ensued. Eventually he drove away, and as we watched him drive away, the back wheel rolled off in the other direction. I haven't been in a Morris Minor since, says Claire Kelly. Well done, you're on your way to the Bord Gáis Energy Theatre. That's about it. Thanks to Colm, indeed all our other guests today. Ruth Kennington was on sound, broadcast coordinator was Sinead Renshaw, research was by John Riley, and Anna Leddy produced. I'm Angus McAnally. Thank you very much. We'll be taking a break now for a few weeks, but we'll see you back here on the 9th of April. But from me, Angus McAnally, goodbye.
The Mooney Show on RTE Radio 1.
On the way soon, The Book Show. This is RTE Radio 1. It's 7 o'clock.
RTE News on Radio 1 with Una O'Hagan. A new opinion poll suggests there would be only minor changes to the general election outcome if voters were asked to go to the polls again. The Sunday Business Post Red Sea poll found the results would be largely the same for most of the political parties. Micheál Lahan of our political staff.
This poll comes amid speculation that another election in the first half of the year is likely should the parties fail to form a government. The survey of more than 1,000 voters between Monday and Thursday found there would only be slight gains for the big parties if an election was called soon. Compared to the general election, Fine Gael support would rise to 27%, that's up 1 point. Fianna Fáil support too would rise by 1 point to 25%. Sinn Féin also getting a 1 point increase, bringing its total to 15%. Labour support falls though by 3 points to 4%. But the independent alliances increases by 1 point to 5%. The Social Democrats are also on 5%, that's up 2 percentage points. But independents drop by 4 points to 9%. The Anti-Austerity Alliance, People Before Profit Group are unchanged on 4%, as are the Greens on 3%.
The National Bus and Rail Union has described as strike-breaking the decision by the Lewis operator Transdev to provide private buses on St Patrick's Day during a strike by tram drivers in the dispute over pay. Transdev has rejected the accusation. The NBRU said it would support Lewis workers in opposing the move. A man has appeared in court in Belfast charged with the attempted murder of a prison officer in a bomb attack in the city 8 days ago. 45-year-old Christopher Alphonsus Robinson of Aspen Park in Dunmurry, County Antrim, was remanded in custody to appear in court again on the 1st of April.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Aer Lingus. Smart likes a lie-flat bed and free Wi-Fi. So for great value transatlantic business travel, smart flies Aer Lingus.
Drizzle or fog occasionally this evening and tonight near Atlantic coasts. A little drizzle elsewhere also, but most places dry and cloudy. Mild overnight with light to moderate southerly breezes. Lowest temperatures 6 to 9 degrees. That's all for now. Next news at 8.
You're tuned to RTE Radio 1. Now, it's time for The Book Show, coming to you from the Mountains to Sea Festival in Dunleary. It's a special Women and Words extended episode celebrating Irish women's writing with readings from Sabina Higgins, Jennifer Johnston, Miriam O'Callaghan, Olivia O'Leary and many more.
Hello there, you're very welcome to The Book Show here tonight at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary. So tonight we're going to be celebrating Women and Words, and over the next hour you're going to hear a lot of very well-known women that you'll recognise reading texts and pieces by Irish women. A few days ago the world celebrated International Women's Day, and here in Ireland there's been some considerable energy surrounding issues which affect Irish women. from gender quotas in the Dáil to arguments over equal pay and, of course, the Waking the Feminist movement, which made headlines around the world. We're delighted that our guests have made the time to be here with us tonight because they all lead very busy, very high-profile lives. And over the next hour, we'll hear many different styles of writing by Irish women, including stories, novels, essays, blog posts and speeches. Tonight, we're letting the words of those women speak for themselves. No explanations, no commentary, just the words to set you thinking. So first up tonight, we're going to hear The Country Girls by Edna O'Brien. It was her first novel and created great controversy when it was published in 1960. It was also banned for its portrayal of independent young women's lives. In the novel, two young women leave rural Ireland for a life in Dublin. Writer Jennifer Johnston introduces us to Baba and Joanna as they head out for a night on the town.
We got ready quickly and went down into the neon fairy land of Dublin. I loved it more than I had ever loved a summer's day in a hayfield. Lights, faces, traffic, the enormous vitality of people hurrying to somewhere. A dark-faced woman in an orange silk thing went by. "Christ, they're in their underwear here," Baba said. The woman had enormous dark eyes with dark shadows under them. She seemed to be searching the night and the crowd for something poignant. Something to equal the beauty of the shadows and her carved cat-like face. "Isn't she beautiful?" I said to Babs. "She's like something dug up," said Baba. She crossed over to look at the glass door of an ice cream parlour. A doorman opened it and held it open, so there was nothing for it but we had to go in. We had two large dishes of ice cream. It was served with peaches and cream, and the whole lot was decorated with flaked chocolate. There were songs pouring out of a metal box near our table. Baba tapped her feet and swayed her shoulders, keeping time with the melody. Afterwards, she put money in the slot herself and played the same songs over again. "Jesus, we're living at last," she said. She was looking around to see if there were any nice boys at the other tables. "It's nice," I said. I meant it. I knew now that this was the place I wanted to be. Forevermore, I thought, I would be restless for crowds and laughs and noise. I'd gone from the sad noises, the lonely rain pelting the galvanised roof of the chicken house, the moan of a cow in the night when her calf was being born. "Are we going dancing?" Baba said. My feet were tired and I told her so. We went home and bought a bag of chips in a shop quite near our avenue. We ate them going along the pavement and the light overhead was a ghastly green. "Jesus, you look like someone with consumption," Baba said, as she handed me a chip. "So do you," I said. There were people looking at us, but we were too young to care. Baba blew into the empty chip bag until it was puffed out. Then she bashed it with her fist and it burst, making a tremendous noise. "I'm going to blow up this town," she said. The first night in Dublin.
Apart from the consumption, it still sounds as fresh as ever. Jennifer Johnston reading there from The Country Girls by Edna O'Brien, which is published by Orion. Now, we're delighted with so many national celebrations and commemorations coming up over the next few weeks that Sabina Coyne-Higgins can join us for our own celebration of women's writing. Sabina will read an extract from a Dáil Éireann debate on Irish women and the extension of the franchise from March 2nd, 1922. The motion was to extend the franchise to women between the ages of 21 and 30. These pieces are the speeches by Countess Markovich and Mrs. O'Callaghan. So please welcome Sabina Higgins.
Mrs. O'Callaghan moved the motion. "I move that a decree be passed for its object the admission of Irish women to the parliamentary franchise on the same terms as Irish men. The women did their own part in the war during the last 5 years, and I think that they should be given the franchise now, and I hope that there is no chachta in the Dáil who is against it. The brave men who put their names to the proclamation of the Irish Republic in Easter week wanted to put men and women on the same footing on the voting register. I feel that I have been treated badly on this motion. I have this cause very much at heart. I was in the Suffrage Society for 10 years. The bill has for its object the admission of these women for the first time to the parliamentary franchise. In other words, it is a bill to enfranchise Irish women between the ages of 21 and 30. I will confine myself to a statement of general principle. The civilization of a country is marked by the position of its women, and by that test, Ireland stands high. The proclamation of the Irish Republic in 1916 was addressed to Irish women as well as to Irish men and guaranteed equal rights to all its citizens. It promised the people a national government elected by the suffrage of Irish men and Irish women. I cannot believe that there is in this Parliament of the Irish Republic a single deputy but holds with me that we ought now to remedy this injustice to a section of Irish women. During these past years of war and terror, these women in their 20s took their share in the dangers. They have purchased their right to the franchise, and they have purchased their right to a say in all the important questions that affect this country. Without their voice or their vote, nobody can say that the will of the whole people of Ireland will have been ascertained. Mr. Griffith, President of the Republic, in reply to a woman's deputation last week on the matter, while declaring his belief in equal suffrage for the sexes, put forward some objections. Madame de Markovich then rose to make her contribution. I rise to support this just measure for women because it is one of the things that I have worked for ever since I was a young girl. That was my first bite, you might say, at the apple of freedom. And soon I got on to other freedoms. Freedom to the nation, freedom to the workers. This question of votes for women with a bigger thing, freedom for women and opening the professions to women, has been one of the things that I have worked for and given my influence and time to procuring all my life, wherever I got the opportunity. As one of the crying wrongs of the world, that women, because of their sex, should be debarred from any position or any right. It has been the habit over in England to use women's suffrage as a party cry. Each party, when it suited them, ran the suffrage question for all it was worth. But when they were in a position to help the cause of women's suffrage, the cry then was, oh, there's something more important to be done for the nation. Now, I am sorry to accuse Mr. Griffith of taking up that English attitude here in Ireland. Mr. Griffith supported the women's suffrage cause, and he never varied when women suffragists were throwing axes at his political opponent, Mr. Redmond. Mr. Griffith in those days spoke his opinions freely as to women's suffrage. I have a vote myself now to send men and women to the dole. And I wish to have that privilege extended to the young women of Ireland, whom I count in every way my superior. When the glorious innocence and intuition of youth, they fixed their eyes on high ideals. They had the education that was denied to me in my youth, and they have proved their valour during the years of the terror in a way that we, the older women, never had a chance to do. There was a dastardly mark about women in men's clothing made just by now by a chapter who spoke. I would challenge the men of honour, the other men, who did not even require women's clothing to get out of the way when the shots were being fired. and any man of the IRA to turn down the girls who stood by the men in the days of the fight for freedom and did what women did in the gap of danger. It is these girls that I speak for today. And it is the experience of these girls had in the last year that has brought to birth in them a great desire for this small privilege, the right of citizenship in Ireland. Many years of organisation, of speechifying and talk did not enable our franchise society to put these ideals into the young women's hearts. But it is the work they have done during the last couple of years when they have been dragged out of their shells and made to take their place as citizens. At the polling booths, helping at the elections, and helping the men on the run. That has put this desire into the hearts of young women. This desire is voiced from every quarter of Ireland. This desire that I feel re-echoing in my own heart. Today, I would appeal here to the men to see that justice is done to these young women and young girls who took a man's part in the terror. The motion was defeated. 38 votes in favour and 47 against.
Thank you, Sabina. Great to hear such rousing words, particularly with so many, a record number of women recently elected in the election. Now, we're outside of Ireland as we celebrate International Women's Day with a song called Bread and Roses. It's very closely linked with the women's labour rights movement, and it's taken from a speech by US union leader Rose Schneiderman, sung here by Lisa Lam and Fiachna O'Brien.
a sudden sun discloses, for the people hear us sing, bread and roses, 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 bread and roses.
Gorgeous, gorgeous. Thanks so much to Fíochna Óibreanán and Lisa Lam. And Lisa Lam's debut album is called Hiding Away. Now, Nell McCafferty's journalism has always broken boundaries. Her searing accounts of the Kerry babies, Bloody Sunday and many civil liberty issues have placed Nell at the heart of Irish reporting. Equally forthright, broadcaster Olivia O'Leary reads here from one of McCafferty's court reports written in the Irish Times in 1974. These reports were a radical departure in social commentary as well as reporting.
A defendant had the audacity in a Dublin district court to attempt to speak for himself. He was quickly silenced. His solicitor suggested that perhaps he, the solicitor, could put the case rather better. Nell pointed out here that the man had only met his solicitor that an hour earlier. Instead, we were treated to the following spectacle. The justice asked whether the man worked. "Do you work?" the solicitor asked the man. "I work," he told the solicitor. "He works," the solicitor told the justice. "How much does he earn?" the justice asked the solicitor. "How much do you earn?" the solicitor asked the man. "£25 a week," said the man. £25 a week, the solicitor told the justice. "Is he married?" the justice asked the solicitor. "Are you married?" the solicitor asked the man. "I am married," the man told the solicitor. "He is married," the solicitor told the justice. And so it went on. The situation points up very clearly the total irrelevance of the defendant to the legal machinations of the court. The minute he walks into the court, the defendant knows that the game is up. He senses authority and might superior to his own. The justice can sentence him, the guard can arrest him, the solicitor can make a poor case for him. He is placed in the dock, in captivity, before his innocence is even considered. He must look up to the throne, reinforcing his own sense of lowliness. The more you prove that you are one of the lowly masses, living in a slum, unemployed, the product of a broken home, the victim of a broken marriage, sick, diseased, preferably crippled, and with a long history of mental breakdown, the more likely you are to be released on probation. It is no coincidence that the only time you are invited to speak freely in court is in terms of your own unworthiness.
Thank you, Olivia O'Leary. And you can read more of those court reports in Nell's book, In the Eyes of the Law, which is published by Poole Beg. Now, staying with journalism, reporter Veronica Guerin's reputation became worldwide long before her tragic death in 1996. She reported on gangland crime in Dublin, something which seems incredibly topical again now at the moment, and as a result, there were a number of attempts on her life. Here, broadcaster Mary McCallaghan reads from a Sunday Independent article, Truth in the Line of Fire, written a year before Veronica's murder. She's home alone, and there's a knock at the door.
My clearest memory is of the gun. It was the first thing, the only thing I really noticed. My eyes were just fixed on it. It was long, grey, steely, shiny, and was pointing directly at me. His gloved hand, which to me appeared massive, just lifted the gun up towards me. I shifted my eyes up to his, I think maybe to appeal to him, I don't know, but he had no eyes, just a black motorcycle helmet. I think it was during this glance upwards that I thought I saw he was very stocky, had dark clothes with a stripe on the jacket. He was a broad, black figure. I don't know if I spoke. I know he said nothing. I really believed I was to be killed. My eyes went back to the steely gun, its length to this day clearly fixed in my mind. I saw the narrow barrel with a little lump at the top of the tip. I don't know why I did what I did next. I do know that I put my hands up to cover my head and I curled myself up into a fetus-like position. My head was still turning backwards, looking at the gun, which I now distinctly felt against my leg. This all happened in a matter of seconds, and I was screaming, or rather roaring, as all of this was going on. My roars came from the pit of my stomach, and then I remember them coupled with the noise of the shot. It wasn't a bang, it was more like the roll of thunder. I don't know if the sound was my roaring or the shot. My next memory is of his footsteps running away. I said aloud, "I've been shot, Jesus help me, I've been shot." I touched my head, my leg was stinging. I saw a little blood but a neat round hole on my leg. I realised I had to get to the phone. I dragged myself about 30 feet up to the cordless telephone. I know the Coolock police station backwards and automatically dialed it. I just said, "Veronica Gearin here, I'm at home and I've just been shot, can you come up?" I switched off the phone. Now I can reflect on the disbelief I felt during those seconds, thinking, they've shot me. The Gardaí arrived. I dragged myself up to the open door. Two band Gardaí, Carmel and Breda, carried me into a room in the house. I couldn't sit in a chair. I sat on the floor. I wanted Graham. The local detectives and special branch arrived. I know the guys personally and reasonably well because of the previous shooting incident in my home. They were comforting me. I could see the shock etched on their faces. They were trying to establish the whereabouts of the ambulance. Cathal Crine and Mick Ryan, both of whom had been keeping fairly regular contact with my family since the first shooting, were holding me. The Gardaí were trying to locate Graham. The phone rang. It was Willie Keeley, my boss. His voice sounded different. "Jesus, Veronica, I've just been told you were shot." "I have," I said, "but I'm okay." The ambulance arrived and the local detective, Cathal Crine, travelled with me. In the ambulance, I tried to call my family because I didn't want them hearing it on the news and fearing the worst.
Thank you, Miriam. A reminder of how much Veronica put herself on the front line in the name of journalism. On a different journalistic track, but equally outspoken, Christina Murphy's Irish Times article from 1974 shows how little attitudes might have changed over the last 40 years. Do women who remain single through choice, and how do we describe women who never married or settled down? Welcome writer and actress Ali White to read from Bachelor Girl, Sarah Spinster.
I remember clearly when a married couple I had not heard from for some time rang me up on a Friday afternoon and invited me to dinner on Saturday night. Funny, I thought. They left it this late to invite me. When I arrived, there were themselves and two men and me. And I no longer thought it funny. I could just see them frantically searching their minds at Friday lunchtime. Who on earth should we ask? Joan? No, she's engaged. And Margaret is going steady and she'd want to bring the boyfriend. Wait, I have it. Christina Murphy. She's not doing a line, is she? Poor girl, they probably thought. She'll have nothing to do on Saturday night with no boyfriend. That was the first time I realised I was being stereotyped and catalogued as spinster. A nice spare partner for a dinner party. It's a syndrome which most single women over 25 are very familiar with. When I was 15 and at school, I reduced the religious knowledge class to hilarity by declaring that I wanted to marry at 18. I think it's what most of the rest of them wanted to do too, but they didn't like to say so. By 18, I have a great appreciation of what marriage in a small Irish town involved, and I had pushed the age up to 23. By the time I reached that magical age, I was abroad and having far too good a time to interrupt the single trail. 27 would be a nice age to marry, I thought. Then I came back to university and thought 30 was a lovely, mature age to marry. Nowadays, I think 35 would be nice, don't you? It's not that I haven't always wanted to marry. I have. But I have always felt there was so much else I wanted to do before I got married. First it was travelling and living abroad. Then it was university. And after that came a career. And rightly or wrongly, I have seen marriage as an obstacle to an interesting and demanding job. I get positively claustrophobic whenever the possibility of marriage presents itself. But people do have these dreadful misconceptions. People solemnly take you aside and tell you you are being too choosy or too bossy, or that men don't like girls who are too independent or too talkative. But possibly worst of all is the smugness of married friends. They settle into their own comfortable little suburban lives, and wives can tend to regard you as a dangerous femme fatale, simply because you are single and available, and their husbands knew you before they were married. And they forget that you have it one way and they have it the other. They have their house, their husband and children, and all the comfort and security thereby entailed, while you have your independence and your extravagance. So when the next married woman expresses surprise at your not being married, tell her there were not enough males in your age group and that unfortunately you lost out. Very unfair, but if she'd like to even things out, she could let you have her husband for the next 10 years.
Sound advice. Thanks so much, Ali White. And that excerpt's actually from a great book called Changing the Times, Irish Women Journalists from 1969 to 1981, and it's published by Lilliput Press. Now, Alison Spittle is a satirical performer, comedian, broadcaster, and tonight she's going to read a blog post that was very widely read last year on the subject of street harassment.
Picture this. Cineworld, Dublin, 2015. A young lad, flanked by his friends, walks up to me silently and places his hands on my face. Now, this wasn't to hurt me physically. This was done with an attitude of, what are you going to do about it? This was a thing for him and his mates to do to pass the time before a film. And that's odd behaviour. And it's odd behaviour that I've become used to. During discussions on street harassment, I've heard people telling women they should be delighted that strangers want to tell you you're beautiful. How are you supposed to feel, though, when strangers want to tell you you're not beautiful? Then, in fact, it's the opposite. How do you feel when you walk across the Haypenny Bridge and hear the words fat bitch whispered into your ear? You turn around to see who it was while a pile of lads walk away laughing. It never happens to me when I'm with people, so I always think I'm overreacting when a man pushes his friend into me, or when a lad runs up to me and says, will you shift my friend? Ah, come on, you're gorgeous. Do you think you're too good for him, huh? While his friend is in fits of mortified giggles, shaking his head. I just laugh and I say no, as if somehow I'm in on the joke. That way I feel we've made a funny little street play. Or I laugh because I'm scared he'll hit me. I mean, if I'm low enough to have my feelings hurt for a laugh, then why not? Then I get a bit sad and I blame myself for wearing a big pink fluffy coat. It's very hard to say big pink fluffy coat. It's very hard, I'm sorry. I'll change the texture. sorry. And I blame myself for wearing a big pink fluffy coat and a headdress. And then I remember, saying something derogatory to a stranger is far more abnormal than wearing a funky animal hat from Penny's. I needed to write this because there's feck all I can do when it happens in real life. I can't go to the Gardaí and say, excuse me, officer, but this young boy has called me Big Mama's house. I demand reprisals. But what can I do to prevent it, you know? Don't be so short, don't be so fat, don't wear bright clothes, don't be on your own. Try not to look so happy. I wish I could tell all the lads that I wish I could just wear a sign that says, hey, don't worry, I look confident because I'm listening to Kanye West, not because I think you want to cuddle me and tell me I'm special. What do I want people to do? Well, I want people to bow down and treat me like the goddess I am. Failing that, I'd like people to cop on and have manners and talk to their loved ones that are young lads and tell them, sometimes in life, you're not going to want to ride someone. And that's okay. Accept it and move on. Give them coping strategies such as breathing exercises. Visualising someone they would like to ride. Or punching themselves in the balls several times. Comments on my appearance. I've aimed to avoid them since I was a teen. I wear mad clothes because from a young age, people would compliment me on my face and tell me how beautiful I would be if I lost weight. And I was sick of people having an opinion on my appearance, telling me I have the potential to be something. I was something already. So I decided to opt out early by not giving a shit. I wore things that I thought were nice, not things that would flatter or hide. My body is what it is, just a body. A thing that walks and hugs. I chose to care more about being sound or funny and getting by on that. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks so much to Alison. And if you want to read the whole post, and I recommend that you should, if you just Google Alison's name and Hosier, I won't say any more than that, but you'll find it. Aisling No Inning A is the latest novel by Eilidh Ní Gualtaigh. It follows a 15-year-old Aisling who has travelled to the UK for an abortion, but is now distributing anti-abortion leaflets in Dublin for her mother. A leif an seo ag an scríbhneoir cluachach, Eilidh Ní Gualtaigh a bhuaigh an gradam pen a nuairic.
Bhí Aisling Cappa seasamh ar chuaigne Rod Hachlainn agus Rod Dawson. Is an sin a bhaic sí ag tuairt amach na milleog. Bhaic Eileen a mórthair i gceartlár an éanaigh ar nó lasmut a Hachlainn. Na biloga. Deir doctorí nach mín gá riamh le ginmhilleadh chun beatha mná a thábháil. Ar ma bhealach go dtí an clinic ginmhilte is se a thuig mé an éireanna. Bhí na biloga go deas. Il dáte lán de grian graf de bhábíní deasa agus mórthracha óga. I bhad ní snasna ná na rudaí a bhí ag an dráim eile. Bhaic nóra ort na biloga bucta suracha a bhí a cuth a scapa gan trácht ar an teachtaracht a bhí únta. Thaisí ar an gúine ar feag gen nó méid ag féchant ar an mórthiúil ag teachta níos Rod Dawson agus ag casa isteach i Rod Hachlainn. Níor bhaic sí le haon bhilog a thuairt d'aon duine. Níor theastaigh uathu. Bhí agla uirthi. Bhí agla uirthi gan an sofa í. Nó go nena cuid an dráim seo fanóid fúthi. Bhí Rod Hachlainn ag lína le daoine. Ní ag an aglais, ní ag an stáit, ag maná amháin atá an ceart. Bhí an slú a mór. Rannig si ar a thuradór. Ní raibh a ceathrú ar an chloig ima a thart. Bhí tuirse ag teacht uirthi. Agus dearí si sais aisteach. Che agus fuair. Eolas domach fliú ag teacht uirthi. Beidir go raibh fliú ag teacht uirthi. Cad tá uinn. Deara leis an uchtú lasú. Cahan atá sé uinn. Anois. Bhartaigh si na biloga a dumpáil áit éigin anois. Agus duch isce nó cupán téin a rud éigin áil. Bhí caféine ar Rod Dawson. Dá bhéiteach si busca brúscar a aimsú, ach ní raibh cean na feiscint. Bhí ebracha bóthair ar siúil ar an tráid, agus bhí gachrod trí na chéile dá bhór. Ar son ráha agus bród dúil as, bhí na gortha ag dul in airde, agus an slua ag dridim le Hachlainn, cé nach raibh aon duine istigh ann le cluas a thuairt orthu. Bródúil. Sin an rud. Ba bhrá le Aisling a bheith bródúil aistí féin. Bródúil, go ndearna si an rud dúlánach. Go ndearna siise cinne. Gur heistil si go lúndan, agus gur chur si deara leis an ghin, a thosaigh sa tlí bródúil sin in aghaidh a tula féin. Ach, ní raibh cead aici a bheith bródúil. Bhí orthi nóra a bheith orthi, agus scó. Bhí orthi an rud a chamad fhí rún, go djón an eor, agus gan an rún sin a scíle le héine riamh in a saol.
Gurmach a bhéilis agus Aisling No Inning A is published by Cuisliffe. Now, tonight we've already heard some inspiring, some funny and some disturbing stories from women's lives. And if she was still alive, one woman we'd love to have on stage just tonight is Maeve Binchy. Sadly, that can't be, but she left behind a lifetime of work which we can still enjoy, not just her novels and many stories, but her warm and often irreverent columns for the Irish Times. Here's Mary McCallaghan again with an article from 1976 with a great title called The Day We Nearly Wrote a Sex Book.
A few years ago, struck by yet another blow, like an increase in the price of fags or drink or huge telephone bills or something, 10 of us sat grumbling in a pub on a Sunday night. We hit on the idea of writing a porn book between us. A porn book with 10 of us. That would only be 3,000 words each, which is nothing really. A 30,000 word novel full of sex. It would have to make us a fortune. And it wouldn't take us a week to write. It was going to be the story of an innocent young American girl who came to Ireland to see the land of her ancestors. She was choosing Ireland because she was fed up with all the immorality in the United States and wanted to be somewhere good and pure. Our boon was going to be the tale of her disillusionment. Because I was writing about tourism in those days, I was asked to write chapter 3, Magnolia Checks Into Her Hotel. Very easy chapter that, they said. Hotels are full of vice and corruption. And I knew a lot of hotel managers. I'd do the thing in an hour. I bleated that most of the hotel managers I met used to talk to me more about getting tourists and getting better grading with Bord Fáilte than about the lust and licentiousness of their staff and clients. Everyone promised to meet with the completed chapter next Saturday. The only pornographic book I had at home was Fanny Hill. And I read it again and again, but there was nothing about hotels in it. By a great stroke of good luck, I was sent to London for 2 days myself, and I went into a terrible shop where I was the only woman, and I told a small evil man that I wanted something about sex in hotels. Hot Honeymoon Hotel, which cost £2, was an amazing book, certainly. But it was mainly photographs. That kind with so many limbs in them, it's like a puzzle in a child's book. And you'd have to colour them in to see which arm or leg belonged to whom. I came home to write the chapter. It took me about 14 hours to write. 10 nice, neat pages of typing with 300 words each on them. I put it in an envelope. On the Saturday, nobody had envelopes or typescripts on the table or anything. I suppose, like myself, they were keeping them out of sight. I said, well, did we all find the porn writing difficult? And somebody looked at me blankly and said, porn writing? Oh, yes, of course, it was a joke. And the others all ratted. So I ratted too and said, naturally, I was only joking. And I went up to the ladies and tore up Magnolia Checks Into Her Hotel into little pieces and burned it in an ashtray and gave up my chance of being a millionaire.
Thank you, Mary. I think we'd all would love to have read Maeve's sex book if it ever came into light. A loss to the world of erotica, no doubt. We're thrilled this evening to be given a sneak preview of Jennifer Johnston's forthcoming novel. It's not out until later this year, but she is going to read a section from Naming the Stars. It's the story of two elderly women who live together in a big house, and in this section, they're getting the dinner ready.
The old ladies ate always in a corner of the kitchen at a round mahogany table that had once sat in one of the windows in the dining room. Aha, said Flora as she came into the room. Should we change for dinner? Nellie laughed. She pushed a pot from one side of the agar to the other. Have you clean hands? Flora held her hands up in front of her. Clean as clean can be. Then sit you down and have a glass of wine. That's a nice dry September sort of wine there. Suitable for us to drink now. She nodded to a bottle on the table. Open, ready for pouring. Did you close the door behind you? With the lights on in the house the way they are in these evenings, the bats come in. We don't want bats in the house, do we? Flora sat down in the wicker chair, which crackled as it took her weight. She shook her napkin open and placed it neatly on her knee. Nellie poured two glasses with great care. You know, Nellie, bats have a most sophisticated radar system. I saw a programme about them on the television once, not long ago. I really don't think that they will come in and bother us. They get in your hair. That's what I've always been told. And they cling. Imagine a bat clinging in your hair. Well, they seemed quite charming little things to me. No danger to life or limb. But to put your mind at rest, I did shut the door. Here's your wine. Her hand trembled slightly as she handed the glass to Flora. Flora stared for a moment at the reflection of the candle flame deep in the glass, like a small animal struggling to get out. She smiled. Who shall we drink to? Give me a name, Nelly. Nelly laughed nervously. I have only the one name. That won't do at all. Here's to Paul, the Major, Father, Daddy. Peace be with you. She hoisted her glass in the air. And Paul, Major, Daddy, darling Daddy, thanks for the wine. The Major. They both swallowed lavishly.
Thanks so much to Jennifer Johnston. Quite a taster there, but you'll have to wait till later in the year when the book will be published by Tinder Press. Now, Louise O'Neill's second novel, Asking for It, dives straight into many issues facing young people today, such as sexual consent and victim blaming in the age of the smartphone. In this scene, Emma and Jamie are in the bathroom at a house party, and the cracks in their friendship are beginning to show.
I bolt the door after Ali, and I sit on the edge of the bathtub. Ali had the presence of mind to tie Jamie's hair into a ponytail, so at least I don't have to hold it back. I check my phone, sending Maggie a Snapchat, taking a selfie and posting it on Instagram, snorting when Matt Reynolds comments on the photo asking for a tit pic. After one violent retch that sounds like it might burst the lining of her stomach, Jamie wipes her mouth, then gets to her feet unsteadily, holding on to the toilet for balance. Do you need help? I ask her. She bends over the sink, splashing her face with water. Standing up straight, she looks at me in the mirror. Her face is blotchy, her eyeliner smeared halfway down her cheeks. What do you care? Jamie, you said it would be better. Jamie, it's not better, Emma. It's not better. Her breath is rasping in her throat. You said. She can barely get the words out through her tears. She looks such a mess. And there must be something wrong with me, because I know I should feel sorry for her, but all I feel is disgust. Look at yourself, I want to tell her. You're ruining your makeup. Don't you even care? I try to shush her, telling her to come on, Jay, you need to calm down. This isn't the right place for this. But she ignores me, sitting on the toilet seat, her head in between her knees, so all I can hear through her wails is, you said that if I, Dylan, you told me to. Come on, Jamie. Just stop it. But you told me. It's happened to loads of people. It happens all the time. You wake up the next morning and you regret it, or you don't remember what happened exactly. But it's easier just not to make a fuss. But that's not how it happened. She stares up at me. I told you what happened. But I wasn't there with you. Was I? I mean, how am I supposed to know what really happened? But I told you. I didn't want to. I didn't want to. You didn't say no. I crouched down in front of her, placing my hands on her shoulders. You told me, Jamie. You told me you didn't say no. But She shrugs my hands off her and looks at me with such despair that my skin crawls. But I didn't say yes either.
And thanks to Louise O'Neill. That's from Louise's book, Asking For It, which was an Irish Book Awards winner recently. It's published by Quercus. I think it's time we have some more music. Find Your Beat by Enie Kay is a song about a river's journey to the sea. The sandbank of the river is continually reshaped by the changing weather. And Enie Kay compares this sort of shapely, curving river to a woman's dancing body as she finds her beat and is drawn ultimately to her destination, which is the ocean. Please welcome Enie Kay with Find Your Beat. Gorgeous. Thanks so much, Etna. Etna records under the name Enie Kay. If you'd like to hear her album, it's called The King Has Two Horse's Ears. Now for a rhythm of a very different kind. Temperamental Miscellaneous is one of Ireland's leading rap and spoken word artists, and she's going to perform two pieces for us now. The one is about her relationship with her mother, called She Built Me a Sky, but the first piece is called Violent Witness.
Sister soldiers, what's mine is yours. Sacrificial product of womb, the occult's doom, only worse. Tender breast, rise, fall, perpetuate calm. Feminine fun poking, joking's apt to provoke harm. Divinity, promiscuity versus virginity. She, tapestries tight, bark over, bite, fighting timidly. Lunar psyche, Venus synchronicity, verbal humility coupled with female fertility. Endometrium soon shed, Elysium moon bled, contemptible prowess from the cradle to the bed. Virgo stand still, a blush, balancing justice. Revive Salmachus, measure with that gender abacus. Philomela-esque revenge if needs be must. Don't need ladies' force, practice being self-courteous. She built me a sky. My mother conquered seas of grief. It filled her days with rain. She clutched a somewhat frail belief. She crumbled under pain. Comprised of words and thoughts and bloods, it seems like any other. I don't deserve, I surely can't, this priceless gift, my mother. She and I, we share one face, her details etched more clear. She buried smiles for miles and miles, letting mine stretch ear to ear. When she had childish thoughts like mine, a clean white sheet to fill, she began to build a sky constructed of her will. Planting all the strongest seeds, gladness fills my heart. This blue sky you painted allows clouds of my mind to part.
And thanks so much to Temperamental Miss Lees. Do check her work out on YouTube. There's a lot of it up there. Well, we're nearly at the end of this Women in Words special for the book show. A huge thank you to all of our readers, all our musicians, to all of you for coming along, and to all of our contributors. Bear with me. Savina Higgins, Olivia O'Leary, Jennifer Johnston, Lisa Lamb, and of course, Fiacna O'Brien, who's wonderful on guitar, Louise O'Neill, Mary McCallaghan, Eilish Ní Guaibhne, Alison Spittle, Ali White, Temperamental Miscellaneous, and Innie Kay. Think I got them all. Thanks so much to the Mountains to See crowd for having us here, and to the Book Show production team. We're back in studio next Saturday at 7 p.m. But we'll leave you this evening with a short story by Emma Donoghue, and a warning that if you want to be in the sisterhood, make sure you're able to spell. Lisa Lamb reads the opening lines here from The Welcome, and thanks and good night.
Women's Housing Coop seeks member. Low rent, Central Manchester. Applicants must have ability to get on with people and show commitment to cooperative living. All ethnic backgrounds particularly welcome to apply. I tore strips off Carola when I noticed that ad taped up in the window of the newsagents next door to our house. She said, I could hardly complain if I'd missed the meeting where the wording of the ad was agreed on, but I should feel free to share my feelings with the policy group anyway. They're not feelings, I said. They're facts. Dear policy group, I typed furiously. Re-recruitment ad. I suggest we use a hyphen in co-op if we don't want the Welcome Cooperative to be confused with a chicken coop. Some other problems with this ad. Seeks member? Sounds like we don't have any members yet. Do you mean seeks new member? And besides, it sounds rather like a giant dildo. Also, I'm curious, why should the applicants have ability to get on with people? And is people a euphemism for women, by the way, given that this is a women-only co-op? And only show commitment to cooperative living. Commitment being spelt with two M's and one T, not vice versa, by the way, in case anyone cares. Or are you suggesting that an applicant might claim to have such a commitment but needs to be forced to show it, for example, through housework? And if so, why not just say so? The way I see it, there's not a lot of point having policies on equal opportunities and accessibility and class and race issues if we're going to keep writing our ads in politically correct gobbledygook that would put off anybody who's not doing a PhD. And speaking of race issues, what on earth does it mean to say that all ethnic backgrounds, members of all ethnic groups, I think you mean, are particularly welcome to apply. Who's not so particularly welcome then? Or do you mean white people don't count as an ethnic group? I cannot believe that one five-line ad can give such an impression of confusion, illiteracy and pomposity all at once. Why can't we just say what we mean? My hands were shaking. So I left it at that and printed out the page. Yours, Luce. I added at the bottom, as if it weren't obvious who'd written it from the letter, from the vocabulary alone. As Dee was always telling me, it's like you've got the Oxford English Dictionary hidden up your arse. She had a point. Some days I sounded more like 80 than 18. I suppose I'd read too many books to be normal.
The Book Show series producer is Zoe Cummins. Rick O'Shea will be back next week for the poetry programme when his guests Elaine Ní Chuilleanáin and Mac Dara Woods mark the 80th edition of the long-running poetry magazine Ciphers. That's next Saturday at 7:30.
RTE Radio 1.
Here at Kia, we have lots of laurels, but we tend not to rest in them. We're much too busy designing, innovating and creating even better cars for our customers. Cars like the all-new Kia Sportage and Optima, and an upgraded seed range that includes our exciting new GT line models. One thing remains a constant, however. Quality so good it comes with our unique Kia 7-year warranty. For more on the Kia range and surprisingly flexible purchase plans, visit your local Kia dealer or log on to kia.com. Kia, the power to surprise.
Coming up after the news, on SCA this week takes a look at some unusual aspects of the celebration of St. Patrick and his feast day as recorded by RTE Radio over the years. This is RTE Radio 1 at 8 o'clock.
On Radio 1 with Una O'Hagan. A new opinion poll suggests there would be only minor changes to the general election outcome if voters were asked to go to the polls again. The Sunday Business Post Red Sea poll found the results would be largely the same for most of the political parties. Micheál Lehane of our political staff.
This poll comes amid speculation that another election in the first half of the year is likely should the parties fail to form a government. The survey of more than 1,000 voters between Monday and Thursday found there would only be slight gains for the big parties if an election was called soon. Compared to the general election, Fine Gael support would rise to 27%, that's up 1 point. Fianna Fáil support too would rise by 1 point to 25%. Sinn Féin also getting a 1 point increase, bringing its total to 15%. Labour support falls though by 3 points to 4%. But the Independent Alliances increases by 1 point to 5%. The Social Democrats are also on 5%, that's up 2 percentage points. But Independents drop by 4 points to 9%. The Anti-Austerity Alliance, People Before Profit Group, are unchanged on 4%, as are the Greens on 3%.
The National Bus and Rail Union has described as strike-breaking the decision by the Lewis operator Transdev to provide private buses on St. Patrick's Day during a strike by tram drivers in the dispute over pay. Transdev has rejected the accusation. The NBRU said it would support Lewis workers in opposing the move. A man has appeared in court in Belfast charged with the attempted murder of a prison officer in a bomb attack in the city 8 days ago. 45-year-old Christopher Alphonsus Robinson of Aspen Park in Dunmurry, County Antrim, was remanded in custody to appear in court again on the 1st of April.
RTE Radio 1 weather with Aer Lingus. Smart likes a lie-flat bed and free Wi-Fi. So for great value transatlantic business travel, Smart flies Aer Lingus.
Drizzle or fog occasionally this evening and tonight near Atlantic coasts. A little drizzle elsewhere also, but most places dry and cloudy. Mild overnight with light.